The headlines. Unidentified militants attack Kabul University campus, leaving at least 19 people dead and 22 others injured. Former CIA Director John Brennan says that U.S. President Donald Trump is likely to put up challenges to the results of Tuesday's presidential election. And the Portuguese government is set to declare a health emergency, enabling stricter restrictions to fight a spike in coronavirus infections. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Afghan Interior Ministry says 19 students have been killed as unidentified gunmen attacked Kabul University. The attack also left 22 others injured. The ministry added that the incident is now over after the three assailants were shot dead by security forces. An explosion and a gunfight erupted when Afghan and Iranian officials were inaugurating a book exhibition at the university. The gunmen traded fire with security forces on the campus following a blast in the area, forcing students to leave. No group has claimed responsibility for the attack. President Ashraf Ghani has condemned the attack, saying that terrorists are attacking academic centers. Emin Alami says that the Afghan government has blamed the Taliban for the recent deadly attack on Kabul University, but the group has denied any involvement in the attack.
I can say about the reactions of Afghan officials as well as many other bodies inside Afghanistan regarding to this recent deadly attack on Kabul University. Amrullah Saleh, the first vice president of Afghanistan, has said that the Taliban is behind such attacks. In the meantime, the spokesperson of Afghanistan's Interior Ministry, Tariq Aryan, also named the Taliban as the mother of all terrorist groups in Afghanistan. In the meantime, analysts have believed that the terrorist groups are after waging more bloodshed and violence among people in order to gain more credit during negotiations in Qatari capital Doha. This is also worth mentioning that some serious obstacles, according to the representatives of the Afghan government delegation, have appeared on the way of an ongoing intra-Afghan talks between government delegation and the Taliban representatives in the Qatari capital Doha. However, later on the day, the Taliban militant group rejected being involved in this brutal attack.
More than 95 million Americans, or American early voters, have cast their ballots just a day before the November 3rd presidential election. The figure is based on a tally from the U.S. Elections Project at the University of Florida. The record-breaking number is equal to 69% of the entire voter turnout for the 2016 election. The sharp increase in early in-person and mail-in voting has been largely prompted by the coronavirus pandemic. Democrats have largely embraced early voting, but U.S. President Donald Trump has sowed distrust in mail-in voting without providing evidence. He has said the process is riddled with fraud. Former CIA Director John Brennan says that the U.S. President Donald Trump is likely to challenge the results of Tuesday's presidential polls.
We have never had someone in the Oval Office who has fueled this type of hatred in our country and fueled the activities that are taking place. When we see, you know, the attempted kidnapping of Michigan Governor Gretchen Whitmer, as well as these aggressive actions on the roads by these Trump caravans, and Donald Trump doesn't not only not condemn them, but he also seems to be fueling that type of aggressive behavior.
In an interview with CNN, Brennan said that Trump has made indications that he is not prepared to accept the election outcome that has Joe Biden as the victor. He said that this is unprecedented, as former U.S. presidents had never refused to accept free and fair election results. Earlier, Trump claimed mail voting will result in election fraud. Election day is getting close in the U.S. Republican President Donald Trump and his Democratic rival Joe Biden have been traveling across the country to win America's vote. The election comes amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic and the economic crisis that has engulfed the country. Biden maintains a national lead in the polls, but Trump is right behind him, especially in key swing states.
On Tuesday, Americans will head to the polls for the 59th quadrennial presidential election. In the final day of campaigning, the two rivals are doing their utmost to win the vote.
You are so lucky I'm your president. You are so lucky.
This is the most important election of our lifetime.
Both Trump and Biden are making a final play for states Republicans won in 2016 ahead of Tuesday election. Their battle for presidency hit the road in recent days. In several instances, Trump supporters disrupted traffic, and in one occasion in Texas, they surrounded a Biden campaign bus. The U.S. president praised all those actions and called his supporters patriots. But Trump assured his supporters that there would be a great red wave of Republican victories next week. He also once again raised the prospect of electoral fraud, including in swing states.
I think it was a terrible decision for our country, and I think it's a very dangerous decision, because you're going to have one or two or three states, depending on how it ends up, where they're tabulating ballots, and the rest of the world is waiting to find out. And I think there's great danger to it. And I think a lot of fraud and misuse can take place.
Such comments raise concerns about the possibility of a looming crisis. A report by Armed Conflict Location and Event Data Project says there is a risk that armed right-wing militia groups may be a source of violence on Election Day and after that. Pro-Trump militia groups have time and again said they will move to an open rebellion if their favorite man does not stay in power. Opinion polls suggest Joe Biden is leading the race, but in swing states, the Democratic candidate's domination is not that solid. Early voting totals have already surpassed 91 million, which is roughly 65% of the 139 million votes cast in 2016. It means that the massive early turnout essentially guarantees that for the first time in history, a majority of ballots will be cast before Election Day.
More European countries are tightening their coronavirus restrictions as infections and deaths surge across the continent. Portugal says that it will declare a health emergency to enable stricter curbs, including a possible nighttime curfew. This comes 2 days after lockdowns were reimposed in most of the country. Greece also imposed a two-week lockdown and canceled all flight in its second-largest city of Thessaloniki in a bid to contain the pandemic. In Italy, the government says stricter measures, including a nighttime curfew and travel restrictions, will be imposed on worst-hit areas. Lockdowns remain in place in Germany. Belgium, which has the world's largest number of infections per capita, has also tightened its coronavirus restrictions. This goes along fresh stay-at-home orders in Britain, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson warned virus deaths in the winter could be twice as high as in the first wave of the pandemic. Coronavirus infections and deaths keep surging across Europe, where fresh restrictions are in place to stem the spread of the disease. Lockdowns and curfews, however, have angered the citizens who are calling for better financial support and policies to cushion the economic blow of the pandemic.
European countries are announcing varying degrees of lockdowns amid a second wave of the coronavirus pandemic and fears that the surge in the number of infections would strain hospital wards across the continent. Italian Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte announced a 6 p.m. curfew for the country's restaurants and cafes, calling for national unity. He said the restrictions can be eased if the infection curve is kept under control. French President Emmanuel Macron decreed a new national lockdown lasting until at least the 1st of December. He warned that the second wave of the outbreak in the country can prove to be even deadlier than the first. In Belgium, Prime Minister Alexander De Croo expressed hope that a team of 11 million citizens would come together in following more stringent regulations. The United Kingdom has also joined the countries that have announced nationwide lockdowns for the second time.
And so now is the time to take action, because there is no alternative. And from Thursday until the start of December, you must stay at home. You may only leave home for specific reasons.
Boris Johnson added that all non-essential retail stores will close down, but there would be no need for citizens to stock up.
Things are very bad in Europe at the moment. The general mass of the population has lost confidence in the government because of their mishandling, and I would say even criminal negligence surrounding COVID-19 since the beginning. China, for example, went on full lockdown on January the 23rd. For 6 weeks, and is now on top of it. Normal life has returned, and the economic growth, for which China is well known, has been restored, because China had what's called a full lockdown.
The stringent measures come as the country's confirmed COVID-19 infections exceeded 1 million, with over 20,000 cases being reported daily.
Europe has once again become the hotbed for COVID-19, accounting for almost half of the world's infections last week. But the government's response by announcing new restrictions and states of emergency have been met with widespread anger. Demos against the measures have been held in several European countries, including Spain, Italy, France, Germany, and the UK. While striking a balance between keeping the economy open and protecting public health has proven to be a daunting task for the governments. The prospect of a slow and incomplete economic recovery, as well as a growing skepticism in authorities' capacity to handle the crisis, is adding to fears of civil unrest and revolt on the continent.
The economic fallout of the coronavirus pandemic, massive layoffs, and rising unemployment levels in Europe have added to already lingering concerns about public health. The mayors of nine cities have bypassed their national governments to write directly to the president of the European Council, Charles Michel, demanding access to the 750 billion euro EU recovery fund. Protesters from across the continent are calling on their governments to provide greater financial support to those hit worst by the pandemic. In Italy, a tipping point appears to be disturbingly close. Angry demonstrations erupted in Naples just over a week ago after a local curfew was imposed. The protests were followed by a civil order in Milan and Turin, where luxury stores were looted. A poll following last week's mini-riots found that over three-quarters of Italians believe there will be more violence in the streets this winter. Experts also believe it is quite likely that countries like France that witnessed unprecedented strikes and protests before the pandemic even began face serious social unrest.
The potential economic damage from the virus and from new lockdowns is, of course, very considerable. Already we've seen European economies shrink at times during this year. And several governments, including the British government, have introduced financial schemes to help companies keep people employed. So, for example, here in Britain, we've had what's called a furlough scheme, where companies are paid 80% of workers' wages while they are in fact at home, not working. But of course, that will be very, very expensive for the country, and Britain and other countries in Europe are running up huge debts and deficits, which will have to be paid off one day.
The stakes were remarkably high before the first lockdowns were imposed back in March, but they may be even higher now.
Thousands of Muslims hold mass demonstrations in Indonesia and Bangladesh in condemnation of French President Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam comments. We discuss the matter further in depth with our guests in our news review program. Let's hear what they had to say.
Honest News Review: Muslims hold mass demonstrations in Indonesia and Bangladesh to denounce French President Emmanuel Macron's anti-Islam comments. Some 50,000 people participated in the anti-Macron rally in the Bangladeshi capital, Dhaka. Also, thousands of Indonesians have gathered near the French embassy in Jakarta, chanting anti-Macron slogans. Earlier this month, Macron's support for blasphemous cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad angered Muslims around the world to trigger demonstrations and boycotts of French goods in Muslim countries. Well, joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Mr. Masood Shajad, who's joining us from London. Also joining us from the British capital, we have CEO of MPACUK or MPAC UK, Mr. Imran Shah. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Shajad in London. Give us your overall view, first of all, about these demonstrations that have been ongoing for the past a few days, and also about the overall stance and the reasons of the anti-Islamic stance of Emmanuel Macron.
Well, really, these demonstrations are highlighting that the Muslims are clearly saying enough is enough. It's enough that every time a politician has found himself or herself in a position that is bankrupt ideologically and is unable and capable of addressing the issues of his country, and becomes unpopular, starts using the Islamophobia card and racist card and abuses Muslims and highlights the pressure which is being put on Muslims to become second-class citizens. No one around the world says that there is sort of absolute freedom of the speech. What these people are saying is that although there is a limitation of freedom of the speech, this does not extend to Muslims and what they consider sacred. And that becomes a sort of open season to attack, to abuse publicly the Muslims to get popularity from extreme right and extremism within their own nation.
Mr. Imran Shah, give us your thoughts on these demonstrations, also about the issue of free speech. We know that there's a lot of hypocrisy when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech in countries like France.
Yeah, and even when it came to a court ruling in 2018, the European Court of Human Rights ruled that any unnecessary degradation of the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, is actually not covered under free speech at all. And yet what you have here is this grandizing and almost crusade-like fever when it comes to freedom of speech, when really this is just a cover for racism and Islamophobia. And yeah, it is about Macron trying to essentially win votes from the far right, but there's also another dynamic as well. Like, just this year, Macron boasted in a public speech stating since 2017 over 200 Muslim businesses has been shut down, over nearly 20 masjids, four cultural centres that are Muslim owned. And what this is also about is that the Muslim communities inside France are now starting to have economic and social advancements in a society that's overtly racist. So they see any minority, not just Muslims, but any minority that is rising through the ranks of a racist society, the elites of that society will do everything they can to crack down on that minority. So this is not simply about, it's not even about free speech. This is about power play amongst a racist elite upon a minority that is demanding to live in peace, to practice their faith, and to be equal citizens of that society.
With that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Bye for now.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is John. You're with me for another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program focuses on few of the most critical, sensitive, and important issues in the subcontinent, a region which hosts almost 25% of the global population. So let's dive into our segment, break down issues, take expert opinion, and see what people say. Please stay with us.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we shall look into China-Pakistan economic belt. Also, we will explore India's fight against digital colonization.
The China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, or CPEC, is a multi-billion dollar infrastructure development project intended to connect Asia with Europe, the Middle East, and Africa. It was officially launched in April 2015 while China's President Xi Jinping visited Pakistan with an estimated cost of about $46 billion. Then the two governments drew up a long-term plan starting in 2017 and drastically expanded the projected timeline for implementation up to 2030. Projected costs ballooned to $62 billion, but Pakistani officials have since mentioned even higher numbers.
Pakistan is struggling with persistent security issues and infrastructure shortages. Therefore, attracting foreign investment is truly difficult. This is when old friend China enters the stage with unexpected largesse to strengthen their ties. Ties once described higher than the Himalayas, deeper than the deepest ocean, and sweeter than honey. Naturally, Islamabad accepts the helping hand, and Pakistan becomes a natural location for China to pilot its ambitious Belt and Road Initiative, BRI. China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, CPEC, launched in 2015 to address Pakistan's persistent power sector and infrastructure woes, is the most developed section of the Belt and Road Initiative to date, connecting Western China with the Arabian Sea via Baluchistan. For Pakistan, the project is advertised as a game-changer that will take Pakistan to new heights of prosperity because of the numerous opportunities it promised to create. But for China, the stakes seem to be even higher because the project is a showcase for the promises or perils of the mother project to other countries. If China succeeds in this part, garnering support for the Belt and Road Initiative may become more realizable.
Since the Chinese President Xi Jinping launched the initiative in 2013, the World Bank estimates about $575 billion worth of energy plants, railways, roads, ports, and other projects have been built or are in the process of being worked all across the globe. Islamabad hopes to use the Chinese capital, production capacity, and know-how from the project in order to upgrade the country's infrastructure and build a mechanism for sustainable growth development. In return, Beijing gains a connection to the Arabian Sea, providing a contingency trade route to the risk-prone Malacca Strait. The narrow stretch of water between the Malay Peninsula and the Indonesian island of Sumatra is the main shipping lane between the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean.
Apart from a patchy portrayal of feasibility for the Belt and Road Initiative, the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor is supposed to serve another agenda for Beijing. Through financing the project, China aims to promote its currency, a goal failed so far as all of the transactions have been made in US dollars instead of yuan. Of course, it was Pakistan, not China, that initially pushed for jettisoning the greenback. Recently, however, there has been a renewed push to look for alternatives to dollar-based project financing and expansion of the renminbi in Sino-Pakistani cross-border trade. Last fall, the two countries announced that renminbi would replace dollar to finance all future energy and transport projects placed under the CPEC umbrella. Pakistan is a flagship for China's Belt and Road, so the need to show progress is crucial, but the progress is increasingly slowing down, if not paralyzed, as some think tanks label it. Why? Probably because BRI's practicality is undermined by accusations that China is luring poor countries into debt traps for its own gain. Pakistan's cluttered political economy, austerity measures imposed by the International Monetary Fund, and now COVID-19 have been other hurdles in the way of the project.
Now for more insight, we are joined by Mr. Shakil Ahmed Rameh, who is a political economist. Mr. Rameh, welcome to the subcontinent. So, what does China-Pakistan Economic Corridor mean for the relations between Pakistan and China? What would it bring for both the countries?
First of all, Pakistan and China say it as an iron brother. So this is a terminology which both countries don't use for any other country. So there you can see how much importance they give to each other. Second thing, so CPEC and China and relationship, they are bringing enormous opportunities for Pakistan and China. First of all, in case of Pakistan, so before launch of the CPEC, Pakistan was going through energy crunch. Every year, Pakistan was losing $4 to $5 billion due to load shedding of electricity. There was huge demand for the road and transport infrastructure. Pakistan needed $1.2 billion to rehabilitate the transport sector, but Pakistan did not have the resources. On top of that, Pakistan was going through the war on terror, and no country, and even our allies, they were not offering us any type of investment and any type of help to overcome these challenges. In this case, China came forward to help us. Or for China, through CPEC route, if China only to trade with the six countries, including Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Netherlands, Germany, France, China can save $70 billion in the transportation. That's why it is called a win-win cooperation.
Okay, what is the significance of the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor for India?
If India become part of CPEC, India can fulfill its dream of connectivity towards Afghanistan and to Central Asia. You know that India always look for the transit trade through Pakistan to reach Afghanistan and Central Asia, but they have problem. Being a part of CPEC, they can utilize the CPEC route to do the trade with the Afghanistan and the Central Asian state. On other side, if the India join the BRI Belt and Road Initiative through an other corridor, Bangladesh, China, Myanmar, and India, so they can officially create link with the CPEC. So they can again use the CPEC route by using the BRI to go for the transit trade with the Central Asia and with Afghanistan. One thing and second thing, India need huge investment for its infrastructure. As we know that there is a problem of infrastructure, there is a problem. When I talk about the infrastructure, it does not only mean road infrastructure, something like that. It also includes education infrastructure, health infrastructure, and other services infrastructure. But India is not able to put forward that money. So they need some assistance from the other country. So it will also bring these opportunities for India to benefit from BRI and also from the Asia Infrastructure and Investment Bank, which has been hosted by China.
Mr. Ramey, our team has collected some global media coverages in this regard, and I would appreciate if you could take a look, and then we can continue with the question and answer session.
The reality is that much of CPEC, like the Belt and Road more broadly, has been paralyzed, said Jonathan Hillman, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, referring to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor. Pakistan is a flagship for China's Belt and Road, so the need to show progress is even more important. China needed a country to showcase its BRI initiative. Pakistan seemed the obvious choice. It was China's only real ally, a security partner, or a vulnerable flank. Meanwhile, a new prime minister, Nawaz Sharif, and his business-friendly Pakistan Muslim League had just come to power, pledging big infrastructure projects and an end to the country's notorious brownouts.
Welcome back, Mr. Ramey, and thank you to the audience as well for staying with us. So, can this project be used to counter the hegemony of the US dollar?
Look, to counter the hegemony, it will take time, at least 3 to 4 decades. China wants to work with the global system, but definitely as the time will go on, China will be the strongest country in the term of economy and its outreach to the BRI. But definitely when they will be the hub of all the economic activities, people will prefer to work with the Chinese currency instead of with US currency.
There are reports of this project being delayed. So what is the reason for the delay of the implementation of this project?
Project is going well, but there are certain challenges or the problem which project is facing from the day one. First of all, the external challenges, the propaganda by the West, especially led by USA and India, because in USA never wanted Pakistan to be the part of the CPEC. That's why they're using a different tools, including FATF. So they have put Pakistan in a gray list by using one way and another way. So it can hinder the investment in the Pakistan. Second thing, that Indians dream of the regional hegemony. It's also creating problem for the Pakistan because Pakistan is not ready to accept the India as a hegemonic power in the region. And other thing is on the internal level. So at internal level, some of the political parties, they are busy to take the credit of the CPEC. If you talk to any political party of the Pakistan, they say, oh, it's due to us. But the reality is that China built this relationship with all the governments from 1952 onward. So this CPEC corridor is a result of the continuous work of all the political parties and the institutions from the both sides, which is from China and Pakistan. So no party can take a credit. But due to this credit game, so when somebody is not in the government, they start to raise the questions, which impact definitely they are the party, they are the part of the parliament. So it's impact the speed of a CPAC. But alhamdulillah, at this point of time, CPAC is going very well. With the creation of the CPAC authority, the speed has been accelerated. We are witnessing every day a new project and a new dimensions in the CPAC. The CPAC has been now expanded in the area of agriculture, cooperation, and science and technology.
Thank you so much, Mr. Ramey, for being with us on our show. Let's see how people on social media see this situation now.
As the spokesperson of China's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Li Jianzhao considers the CPEC project as the flagship of the BRI and believes that it has boosted Pakistan's economy and regional connectivity. Imtiaz Butt believes that CPEC plays an important role in expanding trade potential by connecting China to other parts of Asia and also the Arabian Sea and the Persian Gulf. The official account of the CPEC project refers to the report published by the State Bank of Pakistan that China has poured $103.6 million during the first quarter of the ongoing fiscal year, consolidating its first position as topmost FDI country in Pakistan.
Colonialism means when a country seeks to extend or retain its authority over other people or territories. Now that the age is digital, control over how technology works is the foundation of colonialism. Western big tech firms are reinventing colonialism through the domination of digital technology, exercising imperial control at the architectural level of the digital ecosystem. The current state of affairs is reminiscent of the European colonial era prior to World War I, but the actors have swapped roles. Now the US is exerting global power instead of European superpowers, and digital China is playing the role of the US.
Following the era of politico-military colonization from which countries like India were liberated from the 1945 onwards, colonialism was changing its focus on digital or technological progress. Digital colonialism is rooted in the design of the tech ecosystem for the purposes of profit and plunder. The drivers of colonialism have always been economic, and it signifies the extraction of disproportionate economic benefit from an area of influence through either manipulation of the rules of engagement or through force or deceit. Under classic colonialism, Europeans via corporations like the East India Company took ownership and control of critical infrastructure, including ports, waterways, and railroads. They dispossessed indigenous people of their land, exploited their labor, and perpetuated dependency through strategic underdevelopment. But in the digital age, the rich in the West had to figure out another mechanism to continue to maintain a way to extract disproportionate economic benefits. Therefore, they tried to construct an intellectual monopoly through numerous restrictive information technology structures.
Exploitation of the colonies has never been limited to the economic plunder, but also the intellectual plunder. The West has been constantly trying best to keep knowledge and technology away from the rest of the world. Winner-take-all economics is the reason that the companies in the US and China are able to take advantage of large domestic markets. Meanwhile, India, rather than being pursued by France and Britain, is now the object of attention of both the United States and China. Now, big foreign tech firms are investing in India and taking over the local market. This means a takeover of information infrastructure, a degradation of India's own local tech products, and more neo-colonization.
In their pursuit of profit and power, the rapidly advancing frontier of digital empire is holding the world hostage to a vicious cycle. Western companies create new technologies, then introduce new standards around those technologies through global sci-tech standards and conformity assessment bodies such as IEEE or the International Electrotechnical Commission. This gives them the monopoly rent, a guarantee that they stay above the competitive market at the expense of consumers. Challenging the technology hegemony of the West, China stepped in to disrupt the situation but joined the club and stayed there. Taiwan has become not just a geopolitical issue, but an important outpost for maintaining the structures of digital colonization, as the bulk of the global semiconductors are manufactured in Taiwan using US technology. India, with its massive and growing online populations, needs to review the strategies and regulations for breaking into the technology hegemony of the West or of China. Digital colonialism is a serious threat, not only for India and the global South, but also the entire world. The international community needs to create a fundamentally different tech ecosystem to decentralize technological advances by placing control directly into the hands of the people.
To learn more about this issue, we are joined by Mr. Prabir Purkayastha. He's the co-convener of the JustNet Coalition, which is a global network of civil society actors. Mr. Purkayastha, welcome to the show. So, what is at risk? Why is it so important to stand up against digital colonization?
See, if you look at the companies today, the largest companies by what's called market capital, which is how capitalism measures the size of companies, today are digital monopolies. So effectively, it's the Facebook, it's Google, it's Apple, it's Amazon, and also Microsoft, the five biggies, who essentially are the top of the heap in terms of size and the amount of capital they can generate. So the question is, where is this money coming from? Why is it there so valuable? And it transpires that they, in fact, have our data. Most of them have our data, particularly Facebook and Google, who really are hoovering data from all across the world and have access to it. And of course, that access means they're able to sell us various things. They're able to use essentially us to the advertisers, and that's where they make the big money from. So we may think that we are getting a free service. What we are giving is essentially our data to them, and also our eyeballs, our attention. And this then can be sold to the advertisers, who give, of course, Google and Facebook money. That's really destroying the media in most parts of the world, because Google and Facebook do not generate content. It's the rest of us who do. And that content is what they use in order to get our attention, our eyeballs. And this, somebody has called it attention capital, but essentially it's us being sold as commodities to the advertisers. This is really Google and Facebook's business model.
So what can India do to break the technological hegemony of the West and the big tech?
You see, there are two ways of looking at this. And unfortunately, most of the world may be looking at it the wrong way. The way India seems to be going is, well, we keep the Chinese out because the relationship with India and China have broken down, particularly after clashes in the north. So, but they do not see that instead of China or United States, we could promote not Indian big capital, which is what they're doing at the moment, which is what a lot of countries in the world are doing, but promote public utilities, which says service like search engine, services like, Gmail, all of this should be used as public utilities. They should be, at best, if they're in private hands, they need to be regulated strongly, or they should be broken up. They cannot be allowed to be monopolies. Instead of that, what we are saying, instead of having their monopolies, we should try and build ours. Now, when you try that, these Indian, for instance, Indian big capital is willing to be built up by the government, but at the same time, it also wants money from Google, Facebook to invest and become partners. So this logic will not work. All it will do is it will deliver us as well to Indian big capital along with their partners. So in this case, unlikely to be big MNCs, big capital tech companies from abroad. And that's what we exactly see happening in India today.
Before asking the next questions, let's see the media views regarding this problem, and then we can continue.
Big tech corporations use proprietary software, corporate clouds, and centralized internet services to spy on users, process their data, and spit back manufactured services to subjects of their data fiefdoms. For example, Google siphons user data from a variety of sources, Google Search, Maps, Ads, Android location services, Gmail, to provide them with one of the richest collections of information on the planet. just as oil-producing nations pushed for oil refineries to add value to crude oil, so governments today want the world's big tech companies to build data centers on their own soil. While India is the country with the biggest amount of Facebook users, when you look at the location of Facebook's 15 data centers, 10 are in North America, 4 in Europe, and 1 in Asia, in Singapore.
All right, thank you for staying with us. So, how successful do you think India has been in this? And what else needs to be done?
So India's success is it has been able to build up a couple of Indian capitalist concerns into a certain size. And this size they have built is really based on currently, essentially, the telecommunication monopoly. One of the companies which is started as an oil company, it's now gotten into telecommunications, has built up a monopoly virtually. It's become the leading telecommunication company, mobile as well as internet, as well as other things. So what it has done is say, okay, we are the biggest players in India on how we access people. So everybody has to align with me, otherwise I'll cut your access out. So that is a leverage, but that's a limited success because the future lies not in the access alone, but what do you do with the access? And that's really accessing the people through various services that exist and, of course, the data. Because if they have our data, they know us much better than anybody else. The joke is that the Google and Facebooks know us better than our parents do, mothers do. And therefore, they can sell or use us for business purposes, and that is not provided by just simply providing access. So, in effect, we are already handing over our data and all the tools that they are using to such companies. And as a result, the Indian capitalists may get a cut, but they're not going to be able to dominate the market. The market will be dominated by those who have the data and who develop services based on that data.
Mr. Pulkayastha, thank you for being with us on our show. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace.
Pursana Viswanathan suggests that the Indian government needs to make the giant tech companies understand that they can't intervene in the country's affairs. Vijay Shekhar Sharma also believes that the Indians should try to get independence from the dominance of Google. According to Ellen Barry, although India seems to be a great market for the tech giants, its leaders are cautious about these companies.
So, ladies and gentlemen, that was our episode covering the CPEC issue. Our team works really hard to make sure that you enjoy the show. We'll meet the same day next week.
علي حبه جنة وسيم النار والجنة وسي المصطفى حقا إمام الناس والجنة.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين. Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on sermon number 184 in Nahjul Balagha. And we reached this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam says, وَزَهَادَتُهُ فِي مَا لَا يَبْقَى, that a pious person is one whose asceticism is with regards to those things that are temporary. That means he stays away, he is disconnected and unattached to those things that are temporary. He's not fallen in love with those things that are temporary and are fleeting. And we discussed previously, so in reality, what we see and what attracts us, what we feel, what attracts us in the material sense, not in the spiritual sense. That which attracts us in the material sense, that which seems beautiful to us in the material sense, are all the results of our material structure. And therefore our material structure determines what we feel and how we perceive the environment around us, which is existing the way it is. The thing is that we perceive it in that way because of the way we are. That being the case, one who is attached to the world, one who is attracted to the world, is forgetting to realize the fact that what he is attaching himself to is something that is his kind of his own creation, his own shadow, his own the result of his material structure, and therefore it doesn't have that real value to which he should attach himself to. Now, let us elaborate this a little bit more. You see, there's been a discussion in the books of Tafsir and amongst the scholars as to how comes people worship idols. They worship that which they created themselves, and then they sacrifice themselves and their energies to that which they created with their own hands. That is a very surprising thing, you know, if you go and see. So how can someone do that? What level of lowliness is this that a person reaches this level whereby he is already kind of attached and worships and is in love with that which he has created?
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, someone might find this to be a very natural thing. Of course, because it is your creation, you love it because it's a manifestation of who you are. Yes, if you love it because of a manifestation of who you are in terms of the perfections that are real within you, then it's another thing. But if you are attached to it because of the perfections that you perceive to be real, then that is not valuable. Just imagine if a person worships idols, right? What does he worship in reality? He worships that which he has created and then attaches to that which he has created certain titles. What are those titles? Those titles are all unreal titles. Like they give titles of power, authority, governance, or strength, and you know, different types of titles to them, because they don't worship that idol because of the architecture or, for example, the sculpturism that has happened, that has undergone on that. Of course not. That is just something, that's just a side plus point. The actual thing is because of the kind of titles that they have attached to that idol. Same applied to us is that when we attach ourselves to this worldly material pleasures, if we realize the fact that the way this attachment and this attraction is because of our physical makeup, and therefore it is a manifestation of what we are, and if we give this material issue certain titles that it doesn't deserve, like we give it the title of being deserving of complete and unconditional love, then we are giving it an unreal title, and which is therefore is going to be something that's going to cause destruction to that person.
You are listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, based on what was said, therefore, it is becoming clear to us that when we love other than something that is permanent, especially these worldly issues, they are, because of the fact that they are not independent from us, number one. Number two, because of the fact that they are temporary, because we are temporary, because our bodies and our five senses and our material dimension is temporary, and therefore all those attractions therefore are completely temporary. In fact, they are reflections of what is temporary. Then attaching yourself to that becomes very, very futile. And perhaps that is why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the verse of the Quran says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم ما عندكم ينفد وَمَا عِنْدَ اللَّهِ بَاقٍ, that what is with you is going to diminish, is diminishing, and what is with Allah remains. See, because Allah is independent from us, and the perfections are truly with Him, are really with Him. Not like this material world whose perfections are based on our material makeup, which are also therefore temporary. This being the case, if a person were to contemplate on this issue, he would realize how futile and how diminishing this world is, and naturally therefore وَزَهَادَتُهُ فِي مَا لَا يَبْقَى, he will become ascetic towards the world, and he will feel that this world really does not deserve that attachment, that love, and that worship that a person is giving to it. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that He gives us the opportunity to stay away from being attached to this material dimension in a negative way. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
قال النبي محمد من كنت مولاه هذا علي سيد فاز من ولاه هو بالكتاب مسدد والنور معناه باب العلوم ومرشد هو آيات الله من ناداه أو لبه حين دعاه نال منه هو في الشدائد منجد والفضل يمناه هو في المحاسن أحمد والوحي رباه.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.